Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We're talking about part 4, chapter 16, and I'm a bit gravelly. I'm a bit gravelly because I'm a bit sick. I got sick today. You know when you get sick? I don't get sick that often, but today I did. Part 4, chapter 16. The questions that I asked you guys were these. Is Kitty really as into this as Levin? Kitty is upset about Levin being a big old luzzer. And Levin is becoming increasingly insecure. Is he going to screw this up for himself? I'm Norwegian said, I think Kitty is into it just as much as Levin, at least not far off. Levin being completely honest is a good foundation for them, and in great contrast to Dolly and Stepan's relationship. I didn't read any insecurity in Levin, he just seemed like he was bumbling around happily. He seemed really insecure to me, like he was, it seemed like when they said, when do you want to have the wedding, he was like, today, or tomorrow, or whatever he said. And then he's like, next week. And it felt like he was trying to just get it done as quickly as possible so that it wouldn't, like, disappear. Like, so that she couldn't take it back sort of thing. That's how that read to me. Or maybe he was just really excited. But she was nowhere near as keen to have it done as quickly as him. So that made me think, Levin's really the one pumping the accelerator here. And Kitty's just sort of, well, she's swept up in it too, but not as manically as Levin. And he became sort of more insecure as it went on, I thought, as well. Like, I mean, I think the last few lines of the chapter, however, his happiness was so great that this confession did not impair it, but only gave it a new tinge. She forgave him, but after that he felt yet more unworthy of her, morally bowed still lower before her, and valued still more highly his undeserved happiness. There's three things there that make it sound like he's insecure. Really. First, he says he feels unworthy of her, right? That's insecurity. He morally bowed still lower before her. So he's putting himself morally lower than her. He thinks, he thinks she's above him. And valued still more highly his undeserved happiness. So he thinks he doesn't deserve what he's got. He thinks it's all too good to be true. And that's not a good position to be in a relationship, because I think when you're like that, I don't deserve you. Oh my God, you're so much out of my league. You're so better than me. I'm terrible. You actually, despite all the love you might feel between each other, you start to convince the other person, maybe even subconsciously, that that's kind of true. Like that they maybe are better, too good for you. Or at least they start to believe that the person that they love thinks they're below them, which is not a nice feeling either. So, he did seem really insecure to me. Swims to the mama fish, he said, I found complete honesty, and usually this honesty is always about something bad, can result in the party being completely honest, feeling better, while leaving the recipient feeling worse. Kitty really didn't need to know about his past impurities. Also, Levin having Kitty read his diaries alone rather than telling her himself, if he felt so strongly about the issues, was cowardly. It was a weird thing to do. Like, hell weird thing to do. I mean, to go as far as maybe doing something like saying, you know, face to face, not via a diary, but saying, you know, I've had experience with other girls, I'm not as pure as you in that sense, or something, whatever it was, you know, the way you'd say that back in that day, back in that time and place. They seem to be all about impurity or purity, but you could say it in a way without having to go into the diary and recount what happened. Odd. Odd move there by Levin. Sorry, where am I up to? I was just skimming through the comments here. Gwynardle said, I know I'm reading this with today's sensibilities in mind, but Levin's obsession with purity in himself and others seems really gross to me. It probably would have been enough to just admit to Kitty he hadn't been entirely innocent without making the poor girl read all the details. Yep, I think so too. I am Norwegian said, I must be old-fashioned then because I was just impressed with his honesty, though I just thought Levin wrote about his own struggle with his shortcomings, not that he explained the acts in any detail. It's unclear, really, isn't it? He could have just said something more vague. Yeah, he could have. Or maybe there was details. Who knows? She was really upset, though, which made me think it was like a count by count in, you know, detailing everything he'd done sort of thing. But it might not have been. Might not have been. Levin, says my fishy, Levin giving Kitty his diaries to read before the wedding is based on Tolstoy giving his future wife his diaries to read before their wedding. Kitty mirrors Sophia's real-life reaction. Tolstoy also had a lot of Steva in himself. Maybe that is why he made the character so likable. From an internet article, link also below, no spoilers. When Count Tolstoy, then 34, asked 18-year-old Sophia to become his wife, he wanted there to be no secrets between them. Before the marriage, Leo gave Sophia diaries in which he described his past intimate relationships with other women, including a peasant servant he had a kid with out of wedlock. Sophia was shocked after reading about her future husband's sexual explorations, but went ahead with the marriage. All of his past is so horrible for me that I think I will never be at peace with him, Sophia wrote. He kisses me and I'm thinking that's not the first time he's been infatuated. I was infatuated too, but in my imagination, while he was involved with women alive and pretty. Simply Productive said, I'm with you, Swim. I think the diary was creepy. Honesty is a great basis for love, but some things can stay in your head. Yeah, I'd agree with that. Some things can stay in your head. Who cares if you've loved someone else before? Life's really long. I mean, he's 34 to her 18. It's double her age. Yeah, who cares? What a weird age gap. I'm 33, so I can't imagine being older than I am now and dating an 18-year-old. Just seems awful, really, to be honest. You want someone you can talk to, and what the hell am I going to talk to an 18-year-old about? No offense if there are any 18-year-olds listening. I'm sure you're a great company. Oh my god, I'm just flicking through the next chapter while I say this because I'm peeking at how long it is. It's a bit of a long one. What do we got there? 2, 4, 6, 7 and a half pages. Golly. Swim said the mama fishy also said, ha, sluzzer. Sluzzer is an easier way of saying slut. Commonly used by bogans. It's not necessarily a derogatory word, unlike the word slut. Here are several urban dictionary definitions of bogan. Oh, cool. Yeah, sluzzer just means you're a bit of a slut. Which is a, I don't know, tongue-in-cheek way of saying that he's slept with more people than she has. Which seems to be the kind of focus of that chapter. Also, sluzzer is just a funny word. Total sluzzer. Give it a whirl sometime. Try that word out. Alright, let's read this next chapter. It's a bit long and I'm a bit tired, so let's get this done. Chapter 17. Involuntarily reviewing the impressions left on his mind by the conversations at dinner and after, Karenin returned to his solitary room. What Dolly had said about forgiveness had merely vexed him. Whether or not to apply the Christian principle to his own case was too difficult a question to be lightly discussed, and Karenin had long since answered it in the negative. Of all that had been said, the words of the silly, good-natured Trovtsin had sunk deepest into his mind. He acted like a brick challenged the other men and killed him. Evidently, everybody had agreed that with that, though they were too polite to say so. However, the point is settled and not worth thinking about, said Karenin to himself, and with nothing in his mind but his impending journey and his work of inspection, he went to his room and asked the doorkeeper who followed him where his valet was. The man replied that the valet had just gone out. Karenin ordered tea, sat down at a table, took up a timetable, and began planning his journey. 2 telegrams, said the valet, entering. Excuse me, Your Excellency, I had only just gone out. Karenin took the telegrams and opened them. The first contained the news that Stremov had obtained the very appointment Karenin had been hoping for. He threw down the telegram and flushed. Rising, he began to pace the room. Kus vult perli dementat, he thought. Kus being those who had had a hand in making the appointment. He was vexed, not so much at having missed the post himself and at having been obviously passed over, as at the incomprehensible and surprising fact that they did not realize how much less suitable than anyone else was that voluble windbag Stremov. How was it they did not see that by giving him that post they were ruining themselves and their own prestige? Something else of the same kind, he thought bitterly, as he opened the second telegram. It was from his wife, and Anna, written in blue pencil, was the first word he saw. I am dying. I beg and entreat you, come. I shall die easy for your forgiveness, he read. Smiling contemptuously, he threw down the telegram. His first thought was that, beyond doubt, it was only falsehood and cunning. She would not hesitate at any deception. She was going to be confined. Perhaps that is the illness. But what can they be aiming at? To legitimize the child, compromise me, and prevent a divorce, he reflected. But there is something about dying. He reread the telegram and was suddenly struck by the direct meaning of the words. Supposing it is true, he said to himself, if it is true, and at the moment of suffering and approach to death, she is sincerely repentant, and I, believing it to be false, refuse to come, I would not only be cruel and everybody would condemn me, but it would be stupid on my part. Peter, keep the carriage. I am returning to Petersburg, he told the valet. He decided to go back to Petersburg and see his wife. If the news of her illness were false, he would go away again, saying nothing, but if she really were ill and dying and wished to see him before her death, he would, should he find her still living, forgive her, and should he arrive too late, he would perform his last duty to her. While on his way, he did not again think about what he should do. With the sense of fatigue and want of cleanliness resulting from a night spent in a railway carriage, Karenin drove through the fog of a Petersburg morning along the deserted Nevsky, looking straight before him and not thinking of what awaited him. He dared not think of it, because when he imagined what would happen, he could not drive from his mind the thought that her death would at once dissolve all the difficulties of the situation. Bakers, the closed shops, night izushiks, and men sweeping the pavements passed before his eyes, and watching all this he tried to stifle the thought of what lay before him, and of what he dared not desire, and yet could not help desiring. The carriage stopped at the porch. A carriage with a coachman asleep on the box and an izokoshchik was standing at the entrance. As he entered the hall, Karenin dragged forth his resolve, as it were, from a remote corner of his brain, and conned it over. It said, if it is all a fraud, then calm contempt and leave again. If true, keep up appearances. The door was opening by the hall porter before Karenin had time to ring. The porter, Petrov, otherwise Kapitonich, looked strange in an old coat, without a tie, and in slippers. How is your mistress? Safely delivered yesterday. Karenin halted and turned pale. Now he clearly realized how much he had desired her death. And her health? Corny, wearing his morning apron, came running downstairs. Very bad, he said. There was a consultation yesterday, and the doctor is here now. Take my things, said Karenin, and somewhat relieved by the news that there was still some hope of her dying, he entered the anteroom. On the hall stand was hanging a military coat, and he noticed it. Who is here? The doctor, the midwife, and Count Vronsky. Karenin passed on to the inner apartments. There was no one in the drawing room, but the midwife, with the lilac ribbons in her cap, came out of Anna's boudoir. She approached Karenin, and with a familiarity bred by death's approach, took him by the hand and led him toward the bedroom. "Thank God you have come. She talks only about you and nothing but you," said she. "Be quick and bring the ice," came the authoritative sound of the doctor's voice from the bedroom. Karenin entered the boudoir. Beside the table, sitting with his side toward the back of a low chair, was Vronsky, his hands covering his face, weeping. At the sound of the doctor's voice, he jumped up, uncovered his face, and saw Karenin. But at sight of her husband, he was filled with such confusion that he again sat down, drawing his head down between his shoulders as if trying to become invisible. Then, making an effort, he rose and said, "She is dying. The doctors say there is no hope. I am entirely in your hands. But allow me to remain here, please. However, I am in your hands. I..." The sight of Vronsky's tears made Karenin aware of the approach of that mental perturbation which other people's visible sufferings always aroused in him, and turning away his head, he went towards the door without heeding what Vronsky was saying. Anna's voice talking about something came from the bedroom. It sounded cheerful and animated, and its articulation was extremely distinct. Karenin entered and went up to the bed. She lay with her face toward him. Her cheeks were rosy red, her eyes glittered, and her little white hands, from which the cuffs of her dressing jacket had been pushed back, toyed with the corner of the blanket, twisting it. She appeared not only fresh and well, but in the best of spirits. She spoke rapidly in a ringing voice with extraordinarily accurate intonations, full of feeling. "Because, Alexis, I am speaking of Alexis Alexandrovitch. How strange and terrible that they are both called Alexis, is it not? Alexis would not have refused me. I should have forgotten, and he would have forgiven. But why does he not come? He is kind. He himself does not know how kind he is. Oh God, what weariness. Give me some water, quick. Oh, but it will be bad for her, for my little girl. Well, all right. Well, let her have a nurse. Well, I agree. It will be better so. He will come back, and it will pain him to see her. Take her away. Anna Arkadyevna, he has come. Here he is," said the midwife, trying to draw Anna's attention to Alexis Alexandrovitch. Excuse me. "Oh, what nonsense," Anna went on, taking no notice of her husband. "But let me have her. Let me have my little girl. He has not come yet. You say he won't forgive me because you don't know him. No one knew him. Only I. And even for me it has become hard. One must know his eyes. Sirza's are just the same. That's why I can't bear to see them. Have they given Sirza his dinner? Don't I know that everybody will forget? He would not forget. Sirza must be moved into the corner room, and Mariette must be asked to sleep with him." Suddenly she recoiled, became silent and frightened, and put her arms before her face as if in expectation of a blow. She had seen her husband. "No, no," she began again. "I am not afraid of him. I am afraid of death. Alexis, come here. I am in a hurry because I have no time. I have not long to live. I shall soon become feverish, and then I shall no longer understand anything. Now I understand everything and see everything." Over Karenin's drawn face came a look of suffering. He took her hand and was about to say something, but could not speak. His lower jaw trembled. He struggled with his agitation, every now and then glancing at her. And every time he did so, he saw her eyes looking at him, and with tender and ecstatic emotion he had never before seen in them. "Wait a bit, you don't know. Wait, wait." She paused as if to collect her thoughts. "Yes," she continued. "Yes, yes, yes. This is what I wish to say. Don't be surprised at me. I am still the same, but there is another in me as well, and I am afraid of her. She fell in love with that other one and wished to hate you, but could not forget her who was before. The other is not I. Now I am the real one, all of me. I am dying now. I know I am. Ask him. Even now I feel it. Here they are, my hands and feet and fingers. Whole hundred weights are on them. My fingers, see how enormous they are. But all this will soon end. I only want one thing. Forgive me completely. I am dreadfully bad, but the nurse told about the holy martyr. What was her name? She was worse. And I shall go to Rome. There is a wilderness there, and then I shall be in nobody's way. I shall only take Zerza and the little girl. No, you cannot forgive me. I know what I cannot be forgiven. No, no, go, you are too good. With one hot hand she held his, while with the other she pushed him away. The perturbation in Karenin's soul went on, increasing, and reached a point where he gave up struggling against it. Suddenly he felt that what he had taken for perturbation was, on the contrary, a blissful state of his soul, bringing him joy such as he had never known before. He was not thinking that the law of Christ, which all his life he had tried to fulfill, told him to forgive and love his enemies, but a joyous feeling of forgiveness and love for his enemies filled his soul. He knelt with his head resting on her bent arm, which burnt through its sleeve like fire, and sobbed like a child. She put her arm around his bald head, moved closer to him, and looked up with an expression of proud defiance. Here he is, I knew. Now, goodbye to all, goodbye. They have come again. Why don't they go away? Oh, take these furs off me. The doctor moved her arms and carefully drew the bedcloth clothes over her shoulders. She meekly lay down on her back and gazed with radiant eyes straight before her. Remember that the only thing I want is your forgiveness. I wish for nothing else. Why does he not come in? She cried, calling to Vronsky on the other side of the door. Come, come, give him your hand. Vronsky came to her bedside and, on seeing Anna again, hid his face in his hands. Uncover your face. Look at him. He is a saint, said she. Uncover, yes, uncover your face, she went on angrily. Alexis Alexandrovich, uncover his face. I want to see him. Karenin took Vronsky's hand and moved them away from his face, terrible with its look of suffering and shame. Give him your hand, forgive him. Karenin held out his hand, without restraining the tears that were falling. Thank God, she cried. Now everything is ready. Only stretch out my legs a little. That's right now, it's splendid. How badly those flowers are drawn. Not a bit like violets, and she pointed to the wallpaper. Oh, my God, when will it all come to an end? Doctor, give me some morphia. Oh, my God, and she began to toss in her bed. The doctor and his colleagues said it was puerperal fever, which in 99 cases out of 100 ended fatally. All day she was feverish, delirious, and unconscious. At midnight she lay insensible with hardly any pulse. The end was expected every moment. Vronsky went away, but came again in the morning to inquire. Karenin met him in the anteroom and said, remain here, she must ask for you, and himself showed him into Anna's boudoir. Toward morning she had become excited and animated, and her thoughts and words flowed rapidly, but again this state lapsed into unconsciousness. On the third day she was just the same, and the doctors gave some hope. That day Karenin went out into the boudoir where Vronsky sat, and having locked the door, took a seat opposite him. Alexis Alexandrovich, said Vronsky, feeling that an explanation was coming. I am unable to think, unable to understand. Spare me, however painful it may be to you. Believe me, it is still more terrible for me. He was about to rise, but Karenin took him by the hand and said, I beg you to hear me. It is necessary. I must explain to you my feelings. Those that have guided me and will guide me in future, so that you may not misunderstand me. You know that I resolve on a divorce, and had even taken steps towards obtaining it. I will not conceal from you that when I took action, I was in a state of indecision. I suffered, and I confess that I was haunted by a desire for vengeance. On receiving the telegram, I came here with the same feelings. More than that, I wished for her death, but he stopped and reflected whether he should reveal his feelings or not. But I saw her and forgave her. The joy of forgiving was revealed my duty to me. I have wholly forgiven. I want to turn the other cheek. I want to give my cloak because my coat has been taken. I only pray God that the joy of forgiving may not be taken from me. Tears filled his eyes, and their clear, calm expression struck Vronsky. That is my position. You may trample me in the mud, make me the laughing stock of the world. I will not forsake her, and will never utter a word of reproach to you, continued Karenin. My duty is clearly defined. I must and will remain with her. If she wishes to see you, I will let you know, but now I think it will be best for you to leave. He rose, and sobs broke his voice. Vronsky got up at once, and stooping before him, looked up into his face without unbending his back. He could not understand Karenin, but felt that here was something high and inaccessible to one with his outlook on life. All right, there we go. Pretty eventful chapter. Have your say about that one over at the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.